The headlines this hour. Iran's president tells an international conference on Islamic unity that Palestine is the first priority of the Muslim world and should not be sidelined. North Korea flexing its military muscle with a ballistic missile launch shortly after U.S. and South Korean envoys discuss its nuclear program in Washington. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president is calling on Muslim nations to remain united and to refrain from divisions.
We seek to ensure stability in Islamic countries, unlike the enemy which tries to create instability. We believe unity is the strategy that the Islamic community should adopt, but the enemy's strategy is to sow discord.
Raisi was making his keynote speech at the opening ceremony of an international conference on Islamic unity that started in Tehran just hours ago. He says that Palestine is the most pressing issue of the Muslim world and should not be sidelined. The president believes the ongoing conference is an ideal opportunity to further promote Islamic awakening. Raisi also urged the Muslim world to stand up to terrorist groups like Daesh. He says corruption, poverty, and terrorism should be eradicated from the Islamic world. President Raisi also encouraged closer scientific, cultural, and media cooperation among Muslim nations. The conference will last 6 days. Earlier we spoke with scholar and lecturer Sayed Hosseini. He is critical of how some Arab leaders are under the influence of the Israeli regime and tells us just how important it is for Muslim nations to put aside their differences and to form a united front against common threats.
The situation of Islamic countries and Islamic nations is a very fragile situation due to incompatibility of the leaders and incapability of the leaders, and also some of them are sellouts to the Zionist regime, like the leaders of the Arab League. You can see that they are in process of having and establishing relationship between themselves and the Israelis. In the wake of all of these, what Ayatollah Raisi was trying to say is that the nations must go ahead with their agenda of freedom of Masjid al-Aqsa. They should not wait for their leaders to come and do something, and also avoiding the differences that they have, and also highlighting the issue of an element like ISIS, which is like a wound in the Islamic body, and the similarity between the aim and objectives of ISIS and the Israelis, which they are doing the same thing, following the same objection, and weakening the Islamic Ummah.
South Korea's military says North Korea has fired at least one submarine-launched ballistic missile into waters off its east coast. The North has not officially confirmed the launch, but it comes shortly after U.S. and South Korean envoys met in Washington to discuss their standoff with the North on Monday. Spy chiefs from the U.S., South Korea, and Japan were reported to be meeting in Seoul on Tuesday. Meanwhile, U.S. Special Representative for the North, Sung Kim, said that Washington seeks diplomacy and has no hostile intent toward Pyongyang. The U.S. and some of its regional allies have condemned North's missile launches. The North says, however, that its nuclear and ballistic missile programs are essential to defend the country against the U.S. invasion. Talks aimed at denuclearizing the North collapsed in 2019 after Washington failed to lift sanctions. Frank Smith says North Korea has lost faith in the U.S. as a negotiating partner.
The Hanoi summit was a tremendous, really, failure for everyone involved, in particular North Korea. North Korea lost faith in the U.S. as any type of negotiating partner. If we go back to the Trump administration and the number of international agreements that Trump really broke, that 2019 Hanoi summit is really a held out as a prime example, where North Korea was willing to negotiate a reduction in its nuclear weapons programs, but the U.S., you know, took a hard line and basically walked away from those talks, and leaving North Korea really with nothing. North Korea is going to continue on the path of developing more and better a nuclear deterrent unless the U.S. comes forward with something to offer to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and, again, draw down the tension on the Korean Peninsula.
On to Washington, where political fallout from that messy withdrawal from Afghanistan is haunting the U.S. administration almost 2 months later. The U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan is now stepping down from his position. In his resignation letter to the U.S. Secretary of State, Zalmay Khalilzad admits that the deal that he brokered between Kabul and the Taliban on a peace process, in his own words, did not go forward as envisaged. The U.S. withdrawal was part of that agreement, but the Afghan government collapsed, and the Taliban took over in just a matter of days as U.S. troops left. Many current and former U.S. officials see Khalilzad as the face of one of Washington's worst diplomatic failures in recent memory. 5 years after a bloody failed coup that rocked Turkey, the government continues its investigation into people with possible links to a U.S.-based movement. Turkish prosecutors now want 150 more people arrested in this connection. Dozens of serving soldiers are among the new suspects. The arrest orders are part of a five-year operation against those with suspected links to U.S.-based Turkish opposition figure Fethullah Gulen. Since then, tens of thousands of military personnel, civil servants, and students have been expelled or held pending trial. Ankara accuses Gulen of orchestrating the 2016 coup, during which more than 250 people were killed, but he denies any involvement. Europe seems to be having a hard time keeping the COVID pandemic in check, with both infections and fatalities growing in several countries. Over 1,000 new deaths in Russia, setting a record single-day toll since the pandemic started. Ukraine comes second with a record daily high of nearly 540 fatalities. Its death toll is already above 61,000. Elsewhere, Bulgaria has logged its highest daily infection since March, with nearly 5,000 new cases. Also, the Czech Republic has registered over 2,500 new infections in a single day. That is the country's highest tally since April. And Poland is witnessing an 85% rise in daily cases compared to the previous week. It had over 3,900 new infections in the past 24 hours alone. Western governments are under pressure to take responsibility for thousands of their citizens stranded in refugee camps in Syria and in Iraq. While many countries have been quick to repatriate them, EU countries are dragging their feet. Bianca Rahimi tells us more from London.
Now in its 11th year, the Syrian refugee crisis remains the world's largest refugee and displacement crisis of our times. 60,000 people, most of them children, live in squalid conditions in these camps. Among them are 2,500 families with purported connections to Daesh terrorists. Painstakingly slow and on a case-by-case basis, EU countries are bringing their citizens home. Germany and Denmark recently repatriated 11 women and 37 children, saying they were either sick or had a guardian in Germany. But Britain, the most reluctant to repatriate its citizens, has only allowed 4 children to return. A report published by Rights and Security International says this is unacceptable. By refusing to bring these children and women back to the UK when it could do so, the British government is abandoning people, including its own citizens, to torture and death. The UK has stripped dozens of women and children of their British citizenship. It cites security concerns for doing so, but the RSI report questions whether this act was driven by racism and gendered stereotyping.
The fact of the matter is that most of the Western anti-terrorism policies are not what they seem. They are draconian in the extreme. They were designed not only to focus in on Muslims in an Islamophobic way, but they were also designed to scare the general British Western public into buying into this war on terror, so-called war on terror, which is in fact just an extension of what I would describe as Anglo-Zionist imperialist strategies in West Asia. So I'm afraid it's just too convenient. It's a shocking violation of the human rights of individuals who have statehood here. And it's a shocking, negation of the responsibility of the states in the West in particular, fobbing these guys off into camps, which are ultimately places where they're going to be preyed upon sexually. They're going to be forced and hoodwinked into perhaps marriages they don't want to do simply because economically they're so desperate.
The fear is that if these children are not saved, they could become a new generation of Daesh terrorists with an even bigger chip on their shoulders. And that is the true security risk that Britain and the rest of the world should be worried about.
Rights groups are calling on governments to treat these children as victims of war. Malnutrition, little access to education, and witnessing violence on a daily basis are taking their toll. And every week, at least two children die. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Ansala movement accuses the U.S. and Saudi Arabia of committing, quote, the most horrible crimes since Riyadh began its war in Yemen.
I call on our people, the Yemen of faith, the sons of faith, to continue their efforts to face the aggression, the American-Saudi aggression, which continues for a seventh year, to commit the most horrible crimes against our people and continues to enforce sanctions and a blockade on our people.
Abdulmalik al-Houthi was addressing Yemeni people amid nationwide rallies held to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. He said that Yemenis will continue their resistance against Saudi-led aggressors until the full liberation of their land from occupiers. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., launched a devastating war against Yemen in 2015 to reinstall the country's former Riyadh-friendly regime. The onslaught has led to the death of tens of thousands of Yemeni people, most of them women and children. Meanwhile, Yemenis have gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities across the country to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Despite the harsh living conditions caused by the years-long Saudi war and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary.
Today, the Yemeni people mark this occasion and tell the world that we can overcome all challenges by trusting God. Despite suffering from brutal aggression, suffocating siege, and limitless conspiracies, Yemenis have managed to achieve victories.
Yemenis said they gathered to send a message to the world that Islam is the religion of peace and so it's a prophet. They called on other Muslim nations to mark this day to renew their loyalty to the Prophet Muhammad. For centuries now, Yemenis used to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary as part of their religious culture. Such ceremonies include various cultural and religious events, like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Dressed in green, the color of peace and mercy, Yemenis celebrate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a great blessing for the whole humanity. People, he say, Muslims around the world should follow the footsteps of the Prophet and stand against the enemies of Islam. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
No end in sight to Israeli expansionism, with the regime now pushing ahead with its illegal settlement activities on the occupied side of the Golan Heights. The Israeli Ministry of Housing says that work has already started on building settler units in the area. Just days ago, the Israeli Prime Minister talked about plans to double and eventually quadruple the number of settlers in the Golan Heights. Naftali Bennett said the settler population there will grow to 100,000. Not only that, he also claimed, quote, the Golan Heights is Israeli full stop. Contrary to Israeli misrepresentations, the area is internationally recognized as Syrian territory. Likewise, all Israeli settlements in the Golan are illegal under international law. The Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the Lebanese Forces Party was behind the killing of seven Shia protesters in Beirut last Thursday. Mariam Saleh has more.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets were fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayyid Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baal Bag al-Hermel. We were killed in Chaldea and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayyid Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
simple question.
Why is Britain increasingly out of stock? The United Kingdom has been hit by shortages in shops, at petrol stations, and in online deliveries. But what's causing this? Some blame staff shortfalls caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But could it be that there's a deeper problem in the country, and one that cannot be easily resolved with a mass-scale vaccination program? After the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union, some claim that it has been an exodus of important workers from Britain that has contributed to this crisis. Amongst this exodus, it has been said foreign lorry drivers have returned to their homelands, while the local working population has been either unwilling or unable to fill this employment void. Shortages became visible and worrying to consumers as the public resorted to panic buying to fill their cupboards, thereby also emptying the shelves. The result is as curious as it is frightening for the public. The impact of these shortages has been to create a real sense that there is some kind of sanctions regime within Britain as the supply chain struggles to get products to shelves, and the products that are there are quickly bought up by a worried public. Online deliveries have also been heavily affected by the breakdown of the stock delivery system, as ministers consider making it easier to enter the UK if you have valid work credentials for haulage. Some point to this as going against the very reasons they voted for Brexit. What's causing these supply shortages? Brexit? Or something else? And how can a country as advanced as the United Kingdom end up with empty shelves and a shortage of basic goods? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How does the public here in a typical part of London feel about the shortage of products on the shelves and online? Here's what they told us.
Quite sad, quite fearful.
Food shortages. I feel like, you know, we all need food, right? So, like, food shortage is going to be bad. I mean, I have food right now in the crib. I don't experience any food shortages, but
I think it's affecting people's lives. I think, you know, for instance, if you go to the, you know, the local shops or the corner shops, you know, they're charging extra money, apparently each item, extra 50, 60 pence or £1 difference. So I think it's quite costing to the public.
Not good.
Not good.
Especially if you've got kids.
I do understand some shelves are empty or getting empty, and I've been listening to what the government is doing as well, and I hope that will be sorted out.
A bit worrying. Not saying that I'm panicking, but I'm just wondering if we're going to cope for the next couple of months if the shortage starts carry on like that. But I mean, I'm cool. I'm still cool until something else happens. But yeah, there's a little worried all the time. But yeah, that's.
I haven't seen any much. I'm still doing my shop normally. I still find the stuff I always buy. Haven't had any problems.
I can't do much about it because you go to Tesco sometime. I heard they haven't had a lot of chicken. Iceland. What can you do about it?
Well, I live in London and there is no shortage here. So I am up country naturally. Less resources, less population. You'd expect delivery levels would be less as well. So I really don't see a problem with that, to be honest with you. It doesn't affect us down here as such. So, but up north, it's understandable. I don't think there's a real shortage as such.
Hi,
I think it's a mixture of panic buying and stressing the system a bit. So I think people are being too enthusiastic about buying things that they don't really need, and just to say I have it for two weeks of supply, but on the face of it, there's not a real shortage, but we would like to justify it and use Brexit and all the political rhetoric to say that there's a shortage to put a little pressure on the government, which is fun. I like seeing them squeal a bit, but there is I still can buy bread, I still can buy milk, and I still can get meat. So I am covering the core nutrients short proteins. So I don't see a shortage around, to be honest with you.
To be honest, I can't do much about it. A lot of my family is a bit worried, not that worried, but we know that everything's gonna come back, hopefully, fingers crossed. Food will be delivered and yeah, everyone will be fine. I don't know why everyone's panicking, but yeah.
Well, I don't like the fact that there's food shortages, and like, it's really depressing to see that some people won't, like, food is not going around as well as we would like it to, so yeah.
I think it's quite shocking that there's a shortage, because I wouldn't have expected it in London, but I think we're kind of getting through it. It's just quite a difficult time for quite a lot of people.
So what is causing these supply problems? Brexit? COVID? Or something else? The public had a wide range of answers.
It could be a combination of both. I mean, they both kind of happen simultaneously. Yeah. So it's hard to say if it's this one or that one, because they're the most common denominators right now that we could look at in terms of why the shelves are unstocked.
I don't have a shortage. This is complicated now. Yeah. With this coronavirus.
I would say combination, both Brexit and COVID-19 as well.
Brexit definitely as well, because they're shutting down the borders. Obviously, with the only borders we have open right now is the Irish borders, where we can import. So it's harder to export and import indefinitely.
To be honest, I would not blame Brexit and all of it, but I think it's just a lack of years and years of not preparing people, not putting professionals on the ground. There's a lot of youth that they're not finished studying. I think there's a combine of a lot of stuff. It's just a lack of worrying about social and integrate more people doing more labor instead of, you know, there's a lot of lawyers, ITs, but I think there's a lot of, you know, handcrafts and semi-skilled workers. There's not much.
I think it's a combination of all. Yeah, even though with COVID, a lot of people did panic buy, and which was not necessary. But I think with the Brexit as well, with everything, it's the uncertainty. I think that's what it causes panic. And then that's what happens, unfortunately.
Yeah, panicking a lot. Panicking's a big part of it, because especially when the COVID first happened, you saw all the panic buying tissues, hand sanitizers getting run out. So I think, this country needs to learn how to control when a lot of the population's panicking.
Oh, well, it's just timing, just a cacophony of a mixture of different things and different factors coming all at once and hitting us at once. Brexit, COVID, the evergreen, I don't remember, has been stuck in the canal. All of that is culminating in the world supply chain being just in stasis, which has caused it fundamentally to seize up. It is because we're living in a globalized economy, and whenever someone sneezes in China, unfortunately, we will catch the flu, and that's just it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the fragility of the supply chain. The just-in-time theory isn't working as such, and I think fundamentally we need to go back to basics where we grow our own food and build our own cars, go back to the Leland days, go back to the Bedford days when we were an independent country. Now we are so dependent on everybody else, it makes us look weak in the world of eyes and vulnerable to shortages, like we're saying, up north, but not down there.
A lot. I think it's the lack of delivery drivers, a lot, because there's a shortage of petrol as well. Shortage of food, I think it's because of COVID. Brexit is another cause as well, because we left Brexit. So, yeah, I think that's affected a lot of us as well,
I would think maybe right now, because of like the petrol crisis that have been going down, maybe it's the lorries or food deliveries that haven't been like coming in because of everyone's been panicking about like petrol shortage maybe.
I think the shortage of lorry drivers isn't helping a lot, like with the petrol. There's a lot of queues and a lot of people worrying, trying to stock up on things so they don't go like without food for the winter.
So how can it be that an advanced country like the United Kingdom can start suffering shortages of basic goods? Here's what the people here in London told us.
To be honest, if I was to think of Britain, something like this, I wouldn't think it would happen here, because I think that everything was in order and like they would plan ahead so something like this wouldn't happen, but I guess things happen.
Yeah, it's quite shocking that it's happening in London. You wouldn't expect it in like a big country connected to loads of other countries that we have shortages.
Wish I knew. It's panic, I think. Yeah, it's the uncertainty. I think that's what it is. And also, I think the fact that this this freedom of speech, and we, you know, anyone can say whatever they want, and then it causes panic.
That's a good question, to be honest. That's something that I wonder myself all the time. What I've realised is, I don't know, but since this Brexit thing has happened, even though they promised us a whole different story, all this has been happening, panic buying, the country not controlling all these issues and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, wherever you go in this world, sometimes things over, sometimes things get down, you know. Sometimes things is very short, sometimes things is all right. So, I mean, we have to just try to do better for one another, to help one another, to let the things flow. But sometimes things are here and the people are just trying to...
Well, I should ask that the government. I think government should put in place maybe something different in schools. Maybe going towards any technicians and choose different routes in education. I think the education goes so of this going to the same place is media, is performing arts. There's a lot of things I don't see people not taking, all carpenters, you know, engineers. Is all based in everything electrical, nothing on a you know, construction and things like this. So I think there's a lack of, even in agriculture, I think there's a lack of a lot of courses that could be introduced in education, and then just pushing the communities to go in a different place instead of just being concentrated in the same type of things. I think it's just a combine of things. I don't think you just Brexit all the way down, but I just see a lot of things, you know. We are multicultural in this country, so it's complicated.
As I said, I don't really have a strong opinion myself, but the people around me, they think there's just the workers that were there, they simply left to Europe, and that's why there's a shortage now. Yeah, let's see.
I think choices of the politicians, I think they make choices that we pay.
I thought today's world, being in the UK, I would have assumed things would have been put in place properly to make sure such thing should not happen. So I'm really, yes.
That's very sad, you know, because it's very sad if everything stops, you know. But they should bring the army to bring all the goods into this country. What the army is doing? Nothing. They're sitting there and do nothing.
Let's consider the facts. Office for National Statistics data shows that the number of large goods vehicle drivers has fallen from 330,000 in 2016 to 236,000 drivers by 2021. Also, the average age of HGV drivers is 55 and rising, indicating fewer people are applying to become haulage drivers than are leaving the profession. By September 2021, it was estimated there were 54,000 unprocessed HGV licenses in the system, made worse by staff strike action, social distancing measures and home working. The Road Haulage Association now estimates that the UK is short of over 100,000 drivers.
What should the government be doing to solve this problem of shortages and empty shelves? Here's the public's advice to ministers.
Yes, the government should have put some kind of on reserve, should have made sure, because Brexit was happening, this has been going on for a while, so the government should have put an implementation in things before they happen.
I'd say if they want to, you know, put more control into it, they could, like, add in more strict laws, more rules. Like, when the lockdown was happening, they added all these, like, new rules so quickly in order to keep it under control. So I think if they learn how to do stuff like that more, it could help the country a lot.
Well, the government have to send out, I mean, like, people out there to, I mean, spectaculate, like, go in the shop and take all your items and see what is going on, what is sent on top, what is selling for the government price. That's because there are a lot of fake things in this country. Yeah, fake cigarette, fake this, fake that. The people are sending for a lot of money. And that's what messes up the society. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, it's a little bit too late. I think prevention is first thing. but now, pay rates, I suppose, that's the biggest interest for people to actually get the work done. So if pay rates would be increased, they would just go and grab the job and do it. Yeah, but prevention is the first thing, I suppose. Yeah.
It's quite a difficult question, but maybe if the government just helps more vulnerable people, so they don't have to worry, and making sure they don't like crazy buy loads of stuff, because it's unfair for the people who can't get as much things, can't afford travel.
I see the government ain't gonna listen, yeah. You know, but the government should really sort of scrap Brexit, open up the import entries, but that's not gonna happen. The government obviously wants this to happen to cause more hunger, to cause more stress, to cause less food on the street, to put more homeless on the street. Over it, that's what's going to happen in 2030 essentially. Is it going to cause a whole depopulation, mass extermination event?
Yeah.
It sounds crazy, but that's the goal, I guess.
I mean, me personally, I have no clue if they could do it better. But one thing for sure, I think, is they concentrate a lot of things in London. You know, central London is the main things, and maybe we should go somewhere else. Maybe there's the private areas that have a lot of skilled people that, you know, should be, you know, spread, not be just London. This is my opinion.
You can start reinvesting in local industries, local farming. Start supporting and stop cutting the subsidies to the farmers. You need to replace the subsidies that the EU used to give us, and stop talking this nonsense about re-greening or rewilding the land while we have to buy from Spain, from France, from Thailand. We're buying fish from Thailand. I can't believe that. Tilapia, I don't know. We can't grow it here. We have salmon in Scotland. Why don't we subsidize Scotland so the price is competitive with tilapia so we can serve it in the schools? I don't get that one. But it is just the nature of the business, I guess. We don't want to be seen as subsidizing essential. We protect defense economy, which is our missiles, and you have to get the license. But we don't seem to protect our food for some strange reason. We don't buy British. We prefer international food. It tastes better, I'm not lying to you, but it makes us vulnerable, and that's it.
Think twice before you make a judgment. And don't spend your money on silly things. There's a lot of, especially here in Harlesden, a lot of knife crime. So I've heard a lot of train stations have been built, but at the same time, there's a lot of people here that are poor, a lot of people that don't have homes, a lot of homeless people around here, a lot of knife crime, a lot of drugs, a lot of drug dealing. Yeah, this is what Hull's known for.
We asked the public how they feel about the prospect of ongoing out-of-stock products and the very real possibility that this could be the beginning of a long, cold winter of shortages for the entire country.
I don't want to think about it, to be honest. I'm just pushing that idea away. I had already a headache with this petrol thing, you know. So I'm just pushing away that idea. I'm hoping by the end of this year everything will be sorted, or at least the shortages will be sorted, and, you know, everybody could at least have a nice Christmas and everything. But I'm not. I'm not very hopeful, but that's what I'm hoping for.
Very worried. Very. I've got 4 kids, of course. So very worried that will make me. Yeah, it's food. It's not something that is unnecessary or extra. It's food. It's needed.
It will just bring us back to the same depression most of us went through last year in 2020. So I really do hope the government are spending all day trying to figure out a plan to counterattack this upcoming situation for the winter.
Yeah, I was probably trying to get some food supplies for myself. Yeah, frustrating, of course. Yeah, that would be frustrating. I think people might need a little bit of notice if that would happen, so they could survive the winter through. Yeah, there's other ways to get food, but yeah, if there's enough notice, then fair enough. If there's no notice, then very frustrating, of course. I would think of whether I should be actually staying there for long term or not if these things are happening.
Yeah, actually, UK is a highly, highly rated country, apparently, and I think they should
apparently.
Have a little bit. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to rephrase my words, and I think it's a bit weird, so I think it's about time to fix it then.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. And not a case of do. They know they can do something about it, but I think they just want to put the fear into people for whatever crazy reason they choose to do it.
If it got ever got to that, then we would transition to our emergency supplies, and then we'll start rationing food, which is the emergency procedure in every country. But, and I think we have enough rations to stock up to feed us for a long time. So even if it got to that, we would have a plan to get through that. And I'm not really worried about that, to be honest with you. Another point I'd like to touch on, the petrol shortage. There was no petrol shortage. I don't know why people were panic buying petrol. Do you see any more shortages? 1 week after, no shortage. There wasn't a shortage in the first place. I think it's just a mixture of misinformation on social media, as usual, the usual tool. They just say, oh, we have a shortage, let's go and get it. But in essence, I don't think we have a shortage. And I think the government isn't that stupid, to be honest with you. I think some of them are really smart people, some of them are clowns. And the really smart people tend to be planners. And if it ever got to that, we'd have to dip in our emergency situation supplies. And that's it.
Well, everyone will feel upset. Everyone will feel kind of hurt. But it's at the end of the day, it's the politicians. It's the politicians that make the choices. And like I said, we suffer, we pay. If they make a good choice, then it's good for us. If they don't, then obviously we suffer.
I would be unhappy because how are we going to get our food? And it's winter. Nobody wants to step outside. Like, we would want to, like, stock up on food and, like, keep it at our houses instead of coming out and constantly in the cold as well. And, like, it's not... some people have children, so it's not a good time, basically, yeah.
Well, during coronavirus, it was quite similar. There was hardly anything. It was quite difficult for, like, my family because I have to do the shopping, so... it's quite difficult for a lot of people having to worry about things that we shouldn't have to worry about.
Britain stands outside the European Union with supply problems, delivery issues, and self-generated panic buying by the public. So far, and despite assurances from government ministers that they are working to solve the issue, the public remains nervous and unsure that these shortages will be resolved in the months ahead.
This could be the legacy of decisions made by the country and by politicians who seem unprepared and unable to restock empty shelves, plus a haulage sector with 100,000 unfilled vacancies. And all the while, the UK, outside Europe, and in the midst of a supply chain crisis, faces these problems alone as it heads towards what could turn out to be a winter of discontent, out of solutions and out of stock.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the eyes of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, wa Sayyidul Muwahideen, Mawlaya Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he looks at life, one of the first things that he looks at is the concept of death. And when he looks at the concept of death, he doesn't look at it as a concept or as a thing that should bring pain, sorrow, and, I don't know, depression to a person. In fact, on the contrary, since life is short and since we will die, so Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, says, you don't have enough time, which means you need to work. You need to create a civilization. You need to create a better world, not vice versa. Not that you spend your time in entertainment, in wasting time and passing time, because your time is short. You have a mission to accomplish in this world. This is not the time for us to have fun, not the time for us to enjoy ourselves. We will get that, inshallah, once we die, if we go to heaven. But for this life, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah, says, since death is there, so you need to work as hard as you can, as much as you can, make as much use of your time as you can. So that becomes the basis for us to initiate life itself and to embed the foundations and the pillars to respecting the rights of other people, to leave hatred aside, to become more generous, to become more giving, you know, to have such moral values and neglect moral vices like pride and oppression and all these things, because this is not the time for it, right? Amir al-Mu'mineen says, there is not the time for this. Do good, be good, because your time is limited, your time is short. So according to the Alawi thinking, the Alawi way of life, he wants life to have more value, right? And that value should overtake death itself. Because sometimes even him, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's been martyred over 1400 years ago, yet he still lives and echoes through history and through ages, and he will until the day of judgment. Why? Because he did not give himself the chance to, you know, waste time, act in vain, entertain himself. He was working for humanity, for the betterment of humanity, for establishing human rights. And those values that he worked for, they overtaken death itself. For Ali alayhi salam is always alive, right? So that's how we should work, in the same way as Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. Amongst the things that he fought for and he stood for, preserving the life of a human being. And he says that no one has a right to take a right of another person. Even he says in a quote, he says, Al-kaba'aru al-kufru billah, the major sins to deny Allah's existence, and waqatlu nafs, to kill another human soul. So the Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he stood with all his power in order to try to preserve the human life. Let us take a short break and then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So when we look at Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and him trying to preserve the human life, he even stood against people who threaten other people with death. For example, he never used that method where he's put people under the threat of the sword to believe in God, for example, as many others after him did, or before him also did. So he never used that as an excuse to bring people to Islam. Islam never came with a sword. Islam never came with power. Islam never came to force people to, you know, become Muslims. In fact, on the contrary, Islam came to preserve the human life, not shed it, not take it. So you find, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he says himself, "Inna Allah ba'atha Muhammadan nadhiran lil alamin," that Allah send the Prophet as a warner for people. "Wa aminan ala tanzil," and a guardian on the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. "Wa shahidan ala hadhihi al-umma," and a witness on this nation. And then he says, that's the Prophet. But what was the state of people themselves that the Prophet was sent to them? And he says, "Wa antum ya ma'ashar al-Arab," and for you Arabs, "ala ghayr deen," you have your own religion, "wa fi shar," and you're in evil, doing what? "Tusfukuna dima'akum," you are killing one another. So that's the state. "Wa taqtuluna awladakum," and you kill your own children, because back in the day, the pagans, they used to bury their daughters alive, for example. "وَتَقْطَعُونَ أَرْحَامَكُمْ," and you sever your relations with your kin. So this is the state of people, which means there was no human rights whatsoever before the emergence of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Now the Prophet came. He came as a mercy to end all this bloodshed, not to create his own bloodshed. But sadly, after the demise of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, some of them, they went back to their old paganism and they started shedding blood, but now they're shedding blood under the name of Islam. And sadly, that continues our current day today. You see many terrorist groups under many different names, and they're all shedding blood under the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or by the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They even say Bismillah before they behead a person. Now, is this really Islam? Is this really the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Of course not. So it began after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and sadly it still continue. So these people, they turn life into a miserable life for people. Like you see some terrorist groups, they take over some countries and people automatically get terrorized, and you know, things go horribly wrong. And I'm sure you know a lot of examples that I don't want to even mention in here. And so Amir al-Mu'min salamullah alayhi, he says, no, you have to make sure that you work your best, you do your best to preserve the human life, not to take it. And this is just a simple message that we can extract from the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. We will look more at how he looks at human rights, inshallah, in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala ahli nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.